lawyers for the counties will decide this week whether or not to appeal Judge Jeffrey Crabtree's decision to let a ballot question about how to fund public schools stand this fall. HPR's Ryan Finnerty was in the courtroom on Friday for the ruling and joins us to discuss the case.
Morning, Catherine.
Interesting issue.
So the question that's on the ballot is, should the state legislature, the state of Hawaii, be able to implement a surcharge on property taxes to fund public education? And for those who don't know, Hawaii is the only state in the country that doesn't use property taxes to fund education. Here, the property taxes are levied by the county governments, and because we have a statewide school district, state funds pay for public schools across Hawaii. So this constitutional amendment is what it would be. Would allow the state of Hawaii to put an additional tax on certain properties to fund education. And what properties those are is the heart of this issue. The language in the bill says that it would be either visitor accommodations, which is pretty straightforward, or residential investment property valued at $1 million or greater. And that phrase, residential investment property or real investment property, is the crux of the argument. The lawyers for the counties say that that's very vague. Donna Leong, the corporation counsel for the city and county of Honolulu, said, what is investment property? If someone buys a house and lives in it for 30 years and it increases in value like everyone hopes that it would, is that investment property? Are they now getting taxed on paying this additional tax? So that's the heart of the argument, was that this is not an education bill, which is what the kind of the legislature and the attorney general are saying, but that it's a tax bill, and that it opens the door for the state to increase taxes. It gives them broad power to increase taxes without necessarily requiring that they go to fund education, because the argument goes that the state could increase this property tax surcharge to fund education and then decrease funding from general funds.
Right. And so I know with the counties, it's really an issue of like home rule, because this is really the only means for them to tax residents in order to fund their budgets.
Exactly. And it's a big issue, a very sensitive issue with the counties across the board, not just specific to this this bill and this constitutional amendment, because, as you said, it is their only source of revenue. And the counties often feel that they bear a lot of the brunt of the visitor industry and paying for the services that visitors use, like parks and roads. But they don't receive that much of the share of the taxes paid by visitors. The GET, our sales tax, is collected by the state. The accommodation tax, the transient accommodation tax, is collected by the state, and a portion of it is given to each county. So the property tax is all they have, and they're very sensitive to the state government manipulating it or meddling in it at all. It is very much a home rule issue.
And then what about the state's position?
The state's position is that, first and foremost, that the residents need to decide. One of the main points made by the plaintiffs, the city and county and of Honolulu and the other counties, was that in the 1978 Constitutional Convention, the power to tax property or levy property taxes was given to the counties, and that the state doesn't have that power. That was rebuffed by Attorney General Russell Suzuki, who was leading the defense for the state, who said, this is a constitutional amendment. The Hawaii Constitution can be amended either at a constitutional convention like it was in 78, or through ballot measure like we're doing right now. So, and the judge, Jeffrey Crabtree, seemed to agree with the state that that argument didn't really hold much water. And then the main thrust of the defense was that this is not actually a tax, because the argument being levied by the counties was that this is a tax bill. And the state attorney general said that this is not a tax. It's not a new tax. It's simply a surcharge that's calculated off the existing county property tax. So they're just taking the tax that each county has levied on property owners and adding a surcharge to certain properties.
And so I understand there was some discussion, too, about just, like, deleting the heading for the ballot question.
Exactly. And so the one of the main points that was being argued by the counties was that the language in the bill was misleading, including the question itself and the title and the header. And so they have actually agreed to remove the title and the header. So when voters go to the polls in November, they won't see a title on the question. They will just see, ballot amendment and then the question itself. Interesting quirk of this case, the ballots were actually printed on Friday of last week. And so one of the reasons that this was rushed so quickly was that attorneys from both sides wanted to resolve it before ballots were printed. And they didn't want to have to reprint ballots. That would be very expensive and time-consuming, and it's potentially too late to get that done. So the state was petitioning the judge to void the question, and so that it would still appear on the ballot, but that no votes cast for it in either direction would count. And the judge did rule against the counties. He sided with the state, and here's what he said on Friday.
I think it's really important to note that this motion is limited to a request for injunctive relief. In other words, I'm not deciding whether or not the policy choices presented here are a good idea or not. This court is not deciding whether the state should tax or surcharge investment real property to benefit public education. That policy choice is not for this court to decide today under the motion presented. Rather, I'm essentially limited to analyzing and answering three questions. Question number one, which side will win the underlying argument? The court's answer is quite simple. I find that it is, while it is possible the counties could ultimately win on the underlying issue, I do not find it is probable or likely. Question number two, will an irreparable injury result if the vote goes forward as currently scheduled? My answer is no. This is not a situation where by letting the vote go forward, any resulting damage cannot be undone. In fact, most challenges to constitutional amendments occur after the vote, not before. Question number three, is a public interest involved, and if so, does it support granting the injunction? There's no doubt the questions in this case trigger a public interest. You know, it kind of cuts both ways. I think Attorney General Suzuki made this point well in his brief. I mean, yes, there's a public interest in not having an obviously deficient measure on the ballot, but public interest also favors allowing voters to vote on measures adopted by the state legislature unless they are clearly deceptive or misleading. So as far as question number three goes, court finds it cuts both ways and essentially balances itself out.
That was Judge Jeffrey Crabtree, but he emphasized that many of the provisions of our state and the U.S. Constitution are vague, and that they've withstood the test of time, and it's not uncommon for vague language to be used in a constitution, and then it's then left up to legislators or the courts to interpret it and set precedent. Donna Leong was the lead attorney for the challenge for the city and county of Honolulu, and here's how she reacted to the ruling.
We are disappointed in the court's ruling today, but we are determined to be sure that the voters in the November election are fully informed about the language and the consequences of the constitutional amendment that's being proposed by the state legislature.
They're not asking for the actual text of the question to be removed from the ballot. They want the judge to void the question so that there will be a notice when you go into the ballot that you'll see this, but you don't need to vote for it. It's actually very similar to in the primary elections. There was a candidate for a Republican office who, after the ballots had been printed, was found to not be eligible to run for office. And her name still appeared on the ballot, but no votes cast for her counted. So that's sort of what they're asking.
And
for
reaction from other groups?
The Hawaii State Teachers Union was present. Corey Rosenlee, president of that union, was very enthusiastic about the ruling. He's been a strong proponent of the constitutional amendment, opponent of the challenge. The Tax Foundation of Hawaii was present, and they oppose the measure just based on the vagueness of the language. There was also another group, a new group, the Affordable Hawaii Coalition. That's a super PAC that just formed in August specifically to oppose this measure. Both parties will meet with the judge this week to determine the next steps, and we'll hopefully learn more at the end of the week as to how they'll proceed.
All right. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
That was the Conversation's Ryan Finnerty discussing Friday's decision by a Hawaii judge not to invalidate a ballot question. The ball is now in the county's court.
Aloha, I'm Luther Dickinson from the North Mississippi All-Stars, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Over the years here in Hawaii, we've seen the community of Micronesians grow. The clamor's also grown louder about federal reimbursements to communities like Hawaii, Guam, and Arkansas, which also has a large population of Micronesians. Today, HBR's Kuvehi Reishi joins us live with more on a looming deadline that stands to affect health care for three island nations. Morning.
Good morning, Catherine. That's right. We had a gathering last week. A lot of the health officials from the Federated States of Micronesia, the Republics of Palau, and the Marshall Islands all met to discuss the future. So we're looking at those nations are looking at a 2023, so 5 years from now, deadline to the end of economic assistance under what's called the Compact of Free Association, or COFA. And so this is, for those who are not familiar, 3-decade-long agreement where those Pacific Island nations receive visa-free migration, which is what you were talking about. We've seen an influx of a lot of Micronesians, Palau and Marshallese, coming to Hawaii. So visa-free migration, and also this economic assistance while we have a big U.S. military presence there and sort of control over that North Pacific region. So that's that basis of COFA. But in 5 years, the economic assistance portion will end. And what has happened over these past 3 decades, what we've seen is the health systems in these particular health budgets, I should say, in these countries have become almost completely dependent on U.S. funds for their health systems. So, for example, in Micronesia, 95% of the health budget there is dependent on U.S. funding, either under the compact or through other departmental federal funding. And so as they look at this 5-year deadline, they're trying to figure out, okay, are we going to be able to keep the same level of funding? Are we going to be able to transition? How do we do this? So that was part of the discussion that we heard this past weekend. Now, they have been setting aside some of that compact funding into a trust fund to get ready for, to get ready for that 2023 deadline. But there's still a lot of questions. So at this conference, Princeton University grad students studying sort of the mechanics of this funding, Alex Wheatley, sort of gave us some idea of some of those questions.
I think there's a lot of uncertainty about what is going to happen in 2023. It's planned to be it's a quote, shift in modality of funding. So the funds are there, they're switching to a trust fund, but will it really replenish the amount of funding? How long will it last? Those are the sorts of questions, and it's hard to plan in the face of so much uncertainty. But right now, heavy dependence on external financiers is not sustainable.
Right. So self-sufficiency and independence for these countries have long sort of been the goal of this compact, at least in theory. But in practice, a lot of these funds have just become, these governments have been used to having that to pay for operations and not so much to invest in infrastructure or what is needed for the long term. And for those who aren't familiar with sort of the military background to this relationship with these countries. Now, these countries were used for nuclear bombing tests back during World War II. And Minister of Health of the Republic of the Marshall Islands, Kalani Kaneko, kind of gives us a little bit about the impact that his country has seen through that.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people might misunderstand, you know, the contribution and sacrifices that the citizens of the Marshall Islands have taken. You know, the bigger picture, we look at the nuclear legacy, all the nuclear testing that happened. There were more than 50 bombs, nuclear bombs, that were dropped in the Marshall Islands. And the nuclear legacy left us with many diseases that we cannot even explain. So having the health care assistance from the U.S., it's not just going to help us, but I think it'll do some justice for the victims of the nuclear testing.
That's right. So also, you know, in this 5 years that they have left, they're sort of working on what can I do? Where can we find funds? How do we kind of bring down our dependence on U.S. funding? And so they've all got very different. These are really small atolls, not a lot of in terms of resources to use as an economic base. So there's not a lot that they can kind of work on or build up to become more economically self-sustaining.
Yeah, and a lot of the patients come here and are seeing a tripler.
Exactly. So a lot of the push for sort of migrating out of these places is for better health care, better education. And so the hope is by becoming more self-sustaining back home, they can keep their population at home. So Dr. Amias Roberts, Minister of Health in Palau, kind of gave us a rundown of what Palau is doing to become more independent.
You know, in Palau, we've been a little bit innovative in a way that, you know, we're starting to raise some taxes, sin taxes, to you know, and shift some of that to health to address some of the shortfalls. The other thing we have done is we developed a national health insurance, which is a 5% tax for the population, all working people. And it's a 2.5% tax from the employer and a 2.5% tax from the employee. In a way, you know, we're doing these little things to prepare us for the time when, you know, the Compact of Free Association funding stops.
That's right. So we've seen a lot of U.S. agencies sort of gradually pulling out. So U.S. Peace Corps has been pulling out, FEMA's pulled out, the post office out of their presence is sort of beginning to diminish as we get towards that 2023 deadline. But the military component or military presence in the Pacific will continue beyond 2023. Also, the visa-free migration, which we're seeing, is going to continue into perpetuity as well.
Yeah, it's just so interesting because you got all the political developments with the China, you know, in that area.
Exactly. And that's what they're saying is as the U.S. is sort of phasing out its presence, these countries have seen a lot of investment from both Chinese and Taiwanese governments into sort of investing in health. It's a really interesting sort of, yeah, geopolitical dynamic.
Right, but very scary for those island nations because they've been so dependent on the U.S. for so long.
Exactly, and then it might just be a vacuum for some other government to come in and still be equally as dependent on them as well.
Yeah, really something to watch. So I'm glad you're on it.
Yes.
All right, Kuvehi Hiraishi, talking about a very important deadline that is looming for Pacific Island nations in Micronesia under the Compact of Free Association. It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Brittany Light takes us to Kauai, an outpost for a radio station with an interesting past and an uncertain future. Good morning, Brittany.
Hi, Catherine.
So your headline, Time Runs Out for this radio station that tracks time. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a fun story. You know, I lived on Kauai for quite a few years, and I had no idea this existed out there on the Navy base at PMRF, but quite an important tool for timekeeping is there. And for decades and decades, it was the way of keeping correct time on your wristwatch, on the wall-hung clock, whatever you were using. So I was really fascinated to learn about this and find out the deep history there and how it might not be there forever.
And you said that it's been doing this for like 70 years?
Yeah, it started in the 1940s on Maui first, and then in the 70s it moved over to Kauai. And yeah, a radio station that, along with two other stations in Fort Collins, Colorado, were for a long time responsible for keeping time across across North America. There's even reports that this little tiny radio station on Kauai had been used by folks who were trying to keep precise time on their radio-controlled clocks as far away as South Africa at one point.
Wow. It's amazing reach.
It is amazing reach, and so it still works, it still functions, but today GPS has really taken over in terms of the way we keep time and all the things that we use precise time data for, such as, you know, ATM transactions. Even precise time has to do even with how power comes into your house from the electric grid and turns on all the lights. So GPS has really taken over a lot of this. You'll see it everywhere you go, traffic signals, keeping those in sync. But this, I guess, is a really important backup to have because GPS is quite prone to cyber hacking.
Right. So how did this get on your radar?
You know, just Googling around the internet, which I often do when I'm, you know, looking for story ideas. And I stumbled upon this and kept reading and reading and noticed that in the upcoming budget that President Trump has, there's a proposal to cut the funding that supports these radio stations. So I just dove in and really found a lot of fascinating history.
So now what happens if they cut the budget? How large is the budget?
Well, the budget for these three radio stations, the one here in Hawaii and the two in Colorado, is about $6.3 million. So if that money is cut, the radio stations presumably would shut down. Again, we would use GPS. Anything that still uses these today would use GPS. So it's not like we would lose all sense of time if these were to go away. But some of the experts do say that they still are used by approximately 20 million clocks in the United States are still using these radio stations. So presumably those wouldn't work anymore.
So they just zero out the budget? I mean, how many jobs are we talking about?
On Kauai, it's 4 jobs, but it's about a little bit more than 130 jobs related to the radio stations.
So, yeah, that's really fascinating bit of history. And when would this be cut, if it is cut?
Well, the fiscal year 2019 starts in October. So apparently last year these radio stations were also slated to lose their funding, but they did survive. So we'll have to see what happens.
Well, I mean, that's just like another month.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Wow. So I'm really surprised that we haven't heard more about this.
Yeah, I am too. I didn't even know that this existed out there, but now I do, and it has a lot of great history from, you know, commemorative QSL cards that they had celebrating the Hokulea's voyage to Tahiti back in the 70s. I mean, there's so much you can dive into with this story.
Yeah, but I can see how the folks that support this service would like to see it remain in place because it's really kind of a redundancy for our system.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I guess the folks at the federal government are, despite these looming budget cuts, are actually working with Homeland Security to provide them with a proposal that would state, you know, it would hash out all the ways that these radio broadcasts are still relevant and could be this really important backup for when GPS is down.
Yeah, really interesting. Thanks for that story, Brittany.
You're welcome.
That was reporter Brittany Light with today's reality check. To read her full story, visit sybilbeat.org.
The fresh young duo of Kailua Moon performs on Saturday the 15th in the Atherton Studio. Slot key virtuoso Danny Carvalho and singer-songwriter hula dancer Nani Edgar will delight you with their covers of Hawaiian tunes and their original compositions. Reserve your seats today at hprtickets.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Kailua Moon on the 15th, sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
The Girl Scouts of Hawaii was out in front last month talking about its latest STEM program, new badges, and overall campaign to showcase its mission in advance of a big change. It's now seeing competition for members since the Boy Scouts of America has decided to begin to recruit girls. We sat down with the head of the Aloha Scouts, Jeff Sulzbach, about the changes ahead.
Brand new this year for us, our youngest scouts, our Cub Scouts. And this year we have girls who have joined the Cub Scouts, joined their brothers in the Cub Scout program. Those are young people at kindergarten through fifth grade.
So explain to our listeners how you're structuring the program.
Yeah, so our Cub Scout program, this year girls are joining dens with other girls, and the boys are in dens with other boys. The umbrella organization we call a Cub Scout Pack, and so that's all the grades, kindergarten through fifth grade. And they are together in one pack. The meeting together as a group, but then they split off in their dens, boys and girls, by grade. It's really a hybrid model. You know, I think some people are concerned about, you know, is our boys-only program going away? The answer is no. We still have boys working with other boys together, but now they're being joined in the same group, the larger group called a pack, with their sisters or other girls in the neighborhood. And so there'll be some activities together, and there'll be other activities where they'll be separate from one another.
Now, I know when folks think of the Boy Scouts, they think of, like, Eagle Scouts and what a big deal that is. So will that change at all with the girls coming in?
So Eagle Scout will still be a big deal, and we will have girls who are joining our older program called Scouts BSA, and that's what we used to call Boy Scouts. That was the 5th grade through 12th grade program. They're now called Scouts BSA, representing both boys and girls in that program. And in about 3 years, we would expect to award our first girl with the Eagle Scout Award. And those girls will have to complete the same requirements that all the boys complete. So the requirements don't change whether you're a boy or a girl to become an Eagle Scout.
For folks who aren't familiar with the Eagle Scout program, explain what that is.
Yeah, so becoming an Eagle Scout takes years of work. Most young people take from the time they join Scouts at age 11. Most of them don't earn that until somewhere between ages 14 and 16, and they have to have it completed before their 18th birthday at the latest. So years of work going through all the different ranks from the Scout badge all the way up through. We have seven different ranks that you actually advance through. Each of the ranks have different merit badges and different other skills they have to demonstrate along the way. There's leadership requirements at about half of those ranks and community service at all the ranks as well. And finally, the last step before becoming an Eagle Scout, you have to plan and lead a community service project in your community, where you're actually identifying a need and going out and serving that need.
And I know that that's a nice little thing to include on your college application.
Yeah, it sure helps. In fact, some of the military academies give preference points to young people who have become an Eagle Scout, and so many of the colleges also look for that as a evidence of leadership and community service as well, and that's something that benefits them when they go to college.
So tell us about this decision to include girls, because this came about because of a lawsuit and issue about inclusion.
Yeah, partially it was that, and there definitely was pressure and legal pressure to include girls, but what we really saw in the program was families saying, we want our daughters to have the same program that our sons are having. We also had families saying, we're really busy. We've got a lot going on right now. We feel like all we do is drive from here to there, from this activity to that activity. And they said, is there something we can do as a family in our Scout program together? And then the last thing we kept seeing was that siblings participate in Scouts all the time. Younger brothers, younger sisters, they show up for the meetings, and we really welcome that and encourage that. And we were seeing that across the country. And so the national organization last year said, why would we want to fight this? Let's include the entire family and provide scouting to everybody.
What's the biggest challenge, you think, in setting up a separate system for the girls?
Yeah, the one thing we hear from all of our local groups is, will we have enough leaders? Will there be enough volunteers who can step forward and actually help out? If we have more kids come, we need more help. And what we try to reassure them is that each of those kids are coming with their parents, and that's our best source for volunteer support, is from the actual parents themselves.
So how will the inclusion of girls with the Boy Scouts be different than, let's say, the Girl Scout Council?
Yeah, one thing that a lot of people don't always know is that the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts are completely separate organizations. They have been since the beginning. Both programs, I tell people all the time that I'm a fan of the Girl Scouts. I think they've got a great program, but it's a different program than what the Boy Scout program is. One of the differences is the way that we are structured, where we have multiple age groups in the same bigger group, the pack or the troop. The Boy Scout program, the Cub Scout program is 6th grades, kindergarten through 5th grade, and then the Scouts BSA program starts midway through 5th and goes all the way up through 12th. So you have more integration of ages and age groups. You also have organizations like churches and schools that have sponsored the Scout troops and packs for some of them 100 years, and so they have long traditions, long-standing leadership. And then the curriculum itself is different, and each of the programs, the Boy Scout program and the Girl Scout program, have nuances within their programs that are different that really meet the objectives of those organizations. You know, the outdoor program in the BSA's program, I think, is a more pronounced part of the program itself. It's really an important part of how we teach our skills is in what we call the outdoor classroom. And so being outdoors is where we bring it all together. So that's one area where we're different. How young people lead young people, other peers of multiple age groups, is different in the scouting program. And then I would just say that, like any organization, there's just traditions and customs which are different within the organizations. And I have not been involved with Girl Scouts, so I can't really tell you everything that would be different about it. But just from what our families tell us, there's differences. And I would describe it as just being different, that some people prefer one versus the other.
And then what will you do for, like, uniforms?
Yeah, generally speaking, the uniforms are going to remain the same. So the uniforms that our Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, or now Scouts, have been wearing will be more or less similar. The girls in the Cub Scout program have the option of wearing a skort. So we actually now carry skorts in our Scout shop. And we're seeing that a lot of the girls who are joining right now are actually accessorizing their uniforms more, something that the boys didn't necessarily do, but I think the young girls are doing. And we're encouraging that. We welcome that as a way to maybe individualize how they portray themselves in scouting. We do a big STEM event every year. Our old Boy Scout Makahiki, we now call the Ellison Onizuka Day of Exploration. We do it every April at the Blaisdell Exhibition Hall, and also on all the neighbor islands. It's a STEM-focused event. We just started doing that 2 years ago, and one thing we learned was that about 40% of our merit badges have a direct correlation back to a STEM, to sciences, technology, engineering, and math. And it was something we didn't really discover. I think we viewed ourselves being more outdoorsy, and when we started to look at what our actual curriculum was, there's actually a high portion of that that's also STEM-based as well.
And so do you think then the inclusion of girls will help? Because I think in the past, overall, the organization the numbers have gone down, the members.
Yeah, I think nationally there's definitely been a trend line for a decreasing membership. Locally, we've been pretty stable. The last 5 years, we've actually grown slightly, about 7 or 8% over the last 5 years. So we've been real proud of that. But we hope that more young people will join. Anecdotally, we've had some really good results in our first month of recruiting, which starts in August. So we've actually had an increase in number of members joining over the past month.
What are your numbers, roughly?
Yeah, so this year, our recruitment campaign, over the next 4 months, our goal is to add 1,800 new members. And over the course of the month of August, which is the first of those months, we've had about 300 members join over the course of August. And we're just getting started right now.
Okay, and this is statewide?
Statewide, correct. Yep.
Okay. Anything else that you think would be important to talk about just with this new direction that you're taking?
Sure. I would just say that it's new in some regards, and certainly new as far as the members go. The program itself really remains the same. And one of the things that our experts looked at early on was, is there anything specific in our curriculum that's only for boys? And there really wasn't. The types of things we teach, leadership, community service, outdoor skills, those are things that apply equally to both boys and girls. And so we felt that the curriculum itself did not need to change. What we are changing is who we serve and trying to be more broad and more open and diverse in our membership as a whole.
Okay. And any change in the oath or anything?
No. The Scout oath remains the same. The Scout law remains the same. And, you know, as I meet elderly people in the community, they still can recite the same Scout oath and law that they, when they were a young person, is what our young people today say. So it's still the same Scout oath, still the same Scout law. The Scout oath is, on my honor, I will do my best to do my duty to God and my country and to obey the Scout law to help other people at all times, to keep myself physically strong, mentally awake, and morally straight. And we think that really benefits all young people. 12 points of the Scout law. A Scout is trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent.
Well, thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thanks for the opportunity to make sure my memory was still working on air. Thank
okay.
you.
Thanks so much. That was Jeff Selsback, the Scout Executive and CEO of the Aloha Council Boy Scouts of America, talking about a new campaign to recruit girls. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with Christopher Phillips and Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and also what we can look for in our dark island skies. And as usual, tapping into the expertise of Christopher Phillips. We're so grateful to have him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be here. So this week, Stargazers, we still have the quadruplets of Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in our night skies. They can be found from west to southeast after sunset. The moon is waxing this week, but it shouldn't intrude on our stargazing. The sky should remain nice and dark till week's end.
Now, you have some news, I understand, about a legislative push to look for alien worlds?
Indeed. The National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine published a congressionally mandated report last week that states that NASA should lead a large direct imaging mission to study exoplanets. The goals of this mission should be to study these worlds in an attempt to identify habitable planets and search for scientific evidence of life on these alien worlds.
And this isn't something they're already doing?
Well, SETI, or the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, does indeed use telescopes to search for signs of life in space. But mostly they listen for possible radio signals that are bouncing around the galaxy that may indicate the presence of other civilizations. This new mandate calls for NASA to study actual exoplanets.
How would that study be different than SETI's study in terms of the technology, or what would NASA do that SETI isn't doing?
Well, this report calls for NASA to build a large new telescope that is built with the sole purpose in mind of looking right at these exoplanets and studying their atmospheres and anything else they may be able to ascertain.
And would the TMT, if that thing ever gets built, be able to do something like that?
Well, it's not going to be as powerful as this brand new telescope that's proposed.
Oh.
But what's interesting is that this mandate calls for this new telescope, whatever it is, to work directly with the TMT and also the GMT, which is the Giant Magellan Telescope.
And if they don't ever build the TMT, would they have a backup one to have it link with? Or?
I'm sure they'll probably work with someone else, probably the European Extremely Large Telescope.
So from what you're saying, it sounds like a ground-based thing?
Actually, it's more than likely going to be a brand new space telescope. Now, one thing about space telescopes is that they are incredibly expensive. That's why we don't have many of them. So we're not entirely sure where the funding for this brand new telescope is going to come from just yet.
And basically, Christopher, can this sort of go the way of something like the Iran nuclear deal, for example, when another administration comes in, basically, if they don't like it or they don't like this plan, they could just gut it and the thing will just go away?
That is surely a possibility. When it comes to politics being involved with science, anything can happen.
It's Christopher Phillips and another enlightening Stargazer report. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. And we keep Stargazer at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Hi, I'm Graham Wood from The Atlantic Magazine. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
Tomorrow marks the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on New York and the Pentagon. It may stir a number of emotions for many people. Many Hawaii families had loved ones killed that day. Earlier this summer, we came across a woman with a little different story. Alex Tang told us she signed up to serve in the military after visiting the 9/11 memorial through a program that reached out to immigrants that today no longer exists. And even though Tang has left the Army, she's still deeply connected and moved to help our soldiers.
They recruited legal immigrants who has certain language and cultural background. We got recruited into like mostly medical jobs, and they keep our cultural and language background as a resource for the military.
And you speak Mandarin?
Correct. The program's called MAVNI, Military Accession Vital for National Interest. Because we were foreign nationals, we were not allowed to take combat jobs, so most of us chose to stay in medical jobs. So through this program, we got naturalized after basic training.
Explain to us. You were at Schofield. You got out of the military. You were the recipient of a special scholarship. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I applied to the scholarship because there are certain classes I need some financial help with. I'm currently a student in Argosy, Hawaii School of Professional Psychology. I would like to utilize the scholarship to help me with my study and become a psychologist in the future.
And so you just came back from a trip to the East Coast where there was a big effort to raise money for veterans.
Yes. So Raytheon flew me to Boston to participate in a race for Home Base Foundation, which provides treatment for veterans with PTSD, traumatic brain injury, and their families.
And so what was that like?
It was fun. I like running anyways. Running for a good cause is even better. Running is it's more of a mental thing than a physical thing. So the run reminds us to help others to finish their race in life, you know, in combating PTSD, in recovery. So yeah, I see that as a very good cause.
Why did you decide to go into psychology?
I saw a huge need when I was a behavioral health tech on Schofield. I saw people suffering from PTSD, anxiety, depression. And I also saw my providers made a difference through therapy, through treatments. So I see that I can contribute more as a psychologist in the future.
And so you had mentioned that before you signed up, you were able to go to the 9/11 memorial mm-hmm. in New York City. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, I went there with my recruiter. So it is a very overwhelming and life-changing experience. You see the progression, how World Trade Center was before 9/11, and how people suffered and sacrificed themselves for the incident. And from that, you know, back then, everybody who were influenced by the event wanted to enlist. And my recruiter told me plenty of recruiters back then want to just go to combat jobs and switch. But, you know, their friend is recruiting, and they had to stay, and they have to help others to get into the military.
Every year when we mark this anniversary, and knowing that you've been able to serve in the military, I mean, share what that means to you.
It means to serve a country I love, and to contribute to freedom, you know. Freedom is not free. It's the protection of our civilization is our military's job. And to be part of it is to be something bigger than me, to be part of the cause. That's a life-changing experience. I would recommend everybody to have the experience.
I'm sure it means a lot more, too, because you were born in another country.
Yes. Like in China, you know, we didn't have freedom of speech or freedom of religion. Even the internet is not free. So when you come to America, lots of people, I think, take it for granted that they have prosperity, have like freedom to do whatever they want. But when it comes to service, you know, every time when you have to stay up for like duty or you have to deal with something really, really difficult, it reminds you what it means to serve.
And what made you decide to try and apply under this program? I mean, did you know anybody else in China that had done this before?
No. It was through a Facebook group. So a retired lieutenant colonel from Alaska established this MAVNI program. She is a immigration lawyer. She established this program to help legal immigrants to serve in the military and to have a faster path to citizenship. So this program had been running since 2009, on and off, depends on the administration. Right now it's off.
Oh, it's interesting. So they aren't accepting anybody now?
No.
Was it kind of culture shock for you?
I'm kind of, you know, I'm an Asian female, kind of petite. Whenever I mention, hey, I'm in the military, everybody look at me weird. It's different, but it's kind of expected. You know, I watched some movies before I joined. I kind of know the military kind of treat you differently. They're not going to treat you as a girl. You are just a female soldier, you know. for my job, working in a clinic could be slightly different from being in a line unit. I know the line unit is much more difficult than where I was stationed.
Right, but you're there to give support.
Yes, yeah.
And now you're trying to then take it a step further and get your degree in psychology so you can help other veterans.
Yeah, not just veterans. My plan is to probably go back to the military as an officer. So I can probably be a military psychologist and I treat active duty and their families. I think there is a great need for good psychologists in the military. And I see that with my background as enlisted personnel, I can connect with the soldiers better.
And did you see anything during your time in the Army that maybe pushed you in this area, or did you have friends that maybe were going through difficult times?
Well, a lot of my patients were deployed. I was in intensive outpatient program, which runs a six weeks program for PTSD. So we treat combat PTSDs on a daily basis, and their stories are very touching, I see people came back with like guilt, depression for something they couldn't control. And it's hard to get out of the hole, you know? It's I see that I can try my best to help.
So a lot of these were wounded warriors.
Yes. There's a one soldier he joined right after high school, like 18 years old, as a PFC. And he was deployed almost right away after basic training. And through the deployment, first 6 months, all his leadership got killed. So a PFC had to take leadership. Obviously, he ranked up really quick. He was... He was 22, 23 when I met him, and already at E6. But so tragedy really brought him to us. He has severe PTSD. He came to our treatment, and through the 6 weeks, we tried our best to help him. And for severe PTSD cases like that, obviously he needs like long-term treatment. But we saw progress.
And progress keeps Alex Tang going. She's an Army veteran and student at the College for Counseling and Psychology at Argosy University. Tang sat down with us after taking part in a run this summer at Fenway Park in Boston to raise awareness about the plight of our veterans.
It's hot outside, and here in the islands, that could mean all year long. How do people get dehydrated and why? Can just drinking water be the cure? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk with an expert about the best ways to stay hydrated and when to know it's time to get emergency treatment. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
We have to go, but up tomorrow, we check in on the legal struggle over the fortune of heiress Abigail Kovanonakoa. Lawyers are in court today. We would like to hear from you. Call or talk back line and leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.